is Wednesday, December 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. In Spain, authorities have raided an international weapons ring.
Authorities announced the bust on Tuesday and say they uncovered 160 weapons, including assault rifles, explosives, and almost 10,000 rounds of ammunition in raids across three locations.
Plus an update on the deadly earthquake in Croatia, concerns over the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, and what does studying the deep ocean tell us about life on Earth? We'll have these stories and more next. Croatia's military was deployed on Tuesday to aid the cleanup operation after a strong earthquake struck the southeastern European nation. The quake destroyed buildings in a town southeast of the capital and caused at least 7 deaths. The European Mediterranean Seismological Center says the magnitude 6.3 earthquake hit southeast of Zagreb just before 12:20 p.m. local time on Tuesday. A magnitude 5.2 quake struck the same region of Croatia on Monday. Authorities say at least 26 people were hospitalized with injuries, and many more remain unaccounted for. Reuters reporter Matthew Laritana brings us this story about an international weapons ring arrested in Spain.
The arrest in Spain of 3 suspected ringleaders of a multinational arms trafficking ring has not only yielded a massive stockpile of weapons and explosives, but also a warehouse full of Nazi antiques and memorabilia. Authorities announced the bust on Tuesday and say they uncovered 160 weapons, including assault rifles, explosives, and almost 10,000 rounds of ammunition in raids across 3 locations. The Nazi collection, meanwhile, includes portraits of Adolf Hitler, military uniforms, statues, and medals that they say were displayed as if they were in a museum. One of the 3 men arrested is a German said to have connections to far-right groups. The other 2 arrests were a second German as well as a British national. Police say the gunrunners would obtain their weapons from Eastern Europe before selling them onwards to narcotics traffickers on Spain's southern coast.
That was Reuters' Matthew Laritana. American Airlines flew a Boeing 737 MAX with paying passengers from Miami to New York on Tuesday. It's the plane's first commercial flight in U.S. skies since it was grounded after 2 deadly crashes. American Airlines Flight 718 carried about 100 passengers, and Daniel Weiss was one of them.
I like to think that our regulatory system works here. This is one of those regulated industries that should work for us. It was fine. Everyone was chill. Flight attendants were really nice. Pilot was really nice. His wife was on the flight. Yeah, you know, I didn't feel unsafe at all getting on the plane today.
Last month, the Federal Aviation Administration approved changes made by Boeing to an automated flight control system implicated in crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. The crashes killed 346 people in all. In both accidents, the system pushed the nose down repeatedly based on faulty sensor readings, and pilots were unable to regain control. An array of Palestinian militant groups launched rockets into the Mediterranean Sea off the Gaza Strip Tuesday at the start of what they called their first ever joint exercise, which Israeli media described as a show of force organized by Iran. Reuters reporter Emo McCarthy has the details.
A number of Palestinian militant groups launched 8 rockets into the Mediterranean Sea off the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, at the start of what they called their first ever joint exercise. Israeli media described the exercise as a show of force organized by Iran. The 24-hour exercise was announced on behalf of a joint command set up by the groups in 2018, including fighters from Hamas and Islamic Jihad. It includes land and coastal exercises they described as a test of their preparedness for any future confrontation with Israel. Spokesman Abu Ubaida.
These resistance drills are an assurance of the readiness of the resistance to defend our people in all its states and under all circumstances. And the leadership of the resistance is ready for any battle to protect our land and people. God is mighty, and victory to our people and resistance.
Tensions between Iran and Israel have risen since the assassination of a top Iranian nuclear scientist last month. Iran has blamed Israel for his death, but Israel has neither confirmed nor denied it played a role. Tuesday's Gaza missile display did not trigger any sirens in Israel, whose drones keep a close eye on Gaza and which employs a sophisticated missile interception system.
That was Reuters' Emer McCarthy. In Europe, the French health minister says authorities are planning to extend the country's night curfew in regions where the coronavirus is circulating more. That includes eastern France near the border with Germany, Switzerland, and Italy. The extended curfew from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. will start on January 2nd, where it is needed. Health Minister Olivier Véran ruled out any national or local lockdowns in the coming days. And in other regions, the curfew in place since mid-December will be maintained from 8 p.m. to 6 p.m. Restaurants and bars will remain closed until at least January 20th. Iran's state television says the first study of the safety and effectiveness of a coronavirus vaccine in Iran has begun. Details about the vaccine's production remain slim. Dozens are due to receive the locally developed shot in the hardest hit country in the Middle East. The vaccine is produced by Shifa Pharmed, part of a state-owned pharmaceutical conglomerate. It's the first in the country to reach human trials. Iran has struggled to stem the worst coronavirus outbreak in the region, which has infected over 1.2 million people and killed nearly 55,000. A case of the COVID-19 variant that's been reported overseas has now been detected in the United States in the state of Colorado. The AP's Jackie Quinn.
Colorado's governor says the patient is a man in his 20s with no history of travel. He's currently in isolation southeast of Denver, and the Federal Centers for Disease Control has been notified. Public health officials are investigating other potential cases and performing contact tracing to determine the spread of the variant throughout the state. British scientists believe this new virus variant is more contagious than previously identified strains, but the vaccines that are being developed are thought to be effective against this variant as well. I'm Jackie Quinn.
In remarks on Tuesday, President-elect Joe Biden said about 2 million people have been vaccinated, well short of the 20 million goal President Donald Trump had set for the end of the year. VOA has continued coverage of the pandemic on our website. The southern state of Georgia will play a pivotal role in U.S. national politics when voters head to the polls in January to decide two U.S. Senate runoff races. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the election that will determine the balance of power in the U.S. Congress for the next 2 years.
President-elect Joe Biden still on the campaign trail.
We've got a lot of work to do. And I plan to get to work right away doing it. I need two senators from this state. I want to get something done.
Supporting Senate Democratic candidates Reverend Raphael Warnock.
Stand up in this defining moment in American history.
And John Ossoff.
The whole nation's eyes are on Georgia, y'all.
Both men will need to defeat Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler so that Democrats can gain control of the Senate with the tie-breaking vote of Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. If they lose, Republicans will keep the majority, and Biden will have much less political power on Capitol Hill.
The fact is that on both sides, or both chambers, the margins are historically small, so they can't afford to lose any votes from either caucus to push legislation forward. It's going to be a tough battle.
Because the November elections failed to produce outright winners in Georgia, those runoff races have national attention.
Georgia is going to determine, ultimately, the course of the Biden presidency.
But the stakes are high on both sides.
And I think God has put us in this position right now to stand up and tell the world what America's going to be for the next 50 to 100 years.
The Republican candidates pledging they will be the firewall against a Democratic White House and House of Representatives.
I know we're going to hold the line because no one wants the radical agenda of the left.
President Trump rallied for Perdue and Loeffler while falsely claiming he beat Joe Biden in Georgia.
It's rigged. It's a fixed deal.
Those claims of fraud could discourage the president's supporters from turning out to vote.
You know, sit home and say everything is rigged. It's not worth participating in the process. We'd rather pray than vote because, you know, this is a sham. That hurts the Republicans' chances.
A hand recount certified Biden the winner in Georgia by less than 12,000 votes. A close margin that shows the historically Republican state will not be easy to flip.
In order for the Democrats to be successful in January, you have to have maybe centrist or moderate Republicans crossing over.
Early voting is already underway ahead of Election Day on January 5th, 2021. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
And coming up later.
Call may have been placed at his direction. What is more important is who is behind, who are the authority, who makes the calls. So if the bandit group that carried out the attack have subjected themselves to the authority of Shekau, then it means he's the one who finally make the call.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using a variety of space and ground-based telescopes say they have spotted a very rare system of three monster black holes that are on the path to a spectacular collision and merger. The triple black hole system was discovered at the center of three galaxies that had merged with each other. This trinary system is said to be located about a billion light years away and are each separated by distances that range between 10,000 to 30,000 light years. Astronomers say they found evidence that the giant black holes are actively feeding on surrounding material. The system was first spotted by the ground-based Sloan Digital Sky Survey in New Mexico. NASA space telescopes such as WISE, Chandra, Hubble, and NuSTAR were also used to gather data on the triple black hole system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The international community's efforts to compel North Korea to end its nuclear weapons program came to a halt in 2020 following the breakdown of U.S.-led negotiations and the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Jason Strother reports from the South Korean capital that this year's setback will pose challenges for the incoming Joe Biden administration.
Efforts to engage North Korea over its nuclear weapons program never regained momentum after U.S. President Donald Trump and leader Kim Jong-un failed to reach an agreement during their second and final summit in February 2019. James Kim, a senior fellow at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, says the two nations are at a crossroads now. And it will be up to President-elect Joe Biden's administration to overcome these setbacks.
The only way that I think we're going to get any changes on the situation with North Korea is if U.S. decides to make some initial gestures to indicate to Pyongyang that they're ready for talks and negotiations. Otherwise, I just don't see how we're going to break out from the current impasse.
But Pyongyang has not sent any signals that it is ready to resume dialogue with Washington. The regime has not even acknowledged the change of leadership in the United States. Yang Mu-jin, a professor at Seoul's University of North Korean Studies, says this should not be a surprise because of the personal relationship that Kim and Trump developed. Yang says Kim Jong-un's silence is because Trump has called himself a friend, while Biden has called Kim a thug. Yang adds that North Korea's unprecedented lockdown during the COVID-19 pandemic presents another challenge for Washington and Seoul. Pyongyang has closed its borders and has refused Seoul's offer of humanitarian aid. In June, the North severed military hotlines with the South and destroyed a joint liaison office on its side of the inter-Korean border. Analysts say these setbacks make President Moon Jae-in's goal of signing a peace treaty with Pyongyang even more difficult. Hee Jin Koo, a research fellow at the Korean Peninsula Peace Forum in Seoul, says Moon had Trump's support for this effort. But she is not sure if Biden will make this a priority of his yet-to-be-announced North Korea policy.
With the incoming Biden administration, we'll probably see a return to a maximum pressure method.
Ku says that could mean that Biden will restart large-scale joint military exercises with South Korea, which Trump suspended. The Asan Institute's James Kim expects North Korea to offer some clarity on its stance toward the new U.S. administration in January during a ruling Workers' Party conference, which will coincide with Biden's inauguration on January 20th.
If we're going to see any movements from North Korea or any positioning or posturing changes, we're likely to see it within the month of February.
Kim says this will be a key period in determining the direction of U.S. and North Korea engagement. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
Bangladesh has started moving a second group of Rohingya Muslim refugees on Tuesday. It comes despite opposition from rights groups. For Reuters, Francis McGuire reports.
Bangladesh started moving a second group of Rohingya refugees to a low-lying island in the Bay of Bengal on Tuesday, despite opposition from rights groups worried about the new site's vulnerability to storms. Some clutching ducks, pigeons, and chickens in bamboo baskets, others wearing orange life vests and masks against the coronavirus. The nearly 2,000 refugees were taken on five boats from a refugee camp on the border to Bashan Char, an island which only emerged from the sea 20 years ago and is prone to flooding. The measure has sparked criticism from rights groups, which allege that people are being moved against their will. Foreign Minister Abdul Momen has dismissed concerns about the island's safety and accused groups of spreading negative propaganda about people being forced. The government has built a 7.5-mile-long embankment to protect the island from regular storms, as well as housing for 100,000 people. Reuters is withholding the names of refugees going to the island because of the controversy surrounding the relocation, with many refugees keen to stay on the mainland and opposed to the move. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority ethnic group which fled Myanmar for Bangladesh in 2017 following a military-led crackdown. Since then, they've been living in overcrowded and squalid camps in Cox's Bazar. The United Nations says it hasn't been involved in the relocation and urged the government not to force people to move.
Reuters' Francis McGuire. Nigerian security experts are casting doubt on the claim by authorities that tensions between farmers and cattle herders led to the recent wave of kidnappings in the northwestern state of Katsina. More than 300 schoolboys were abducted earlier this month, but later released. Timothy Yibizu has that story.
Authorities in Katsina initially blamed the mass abduction of 344 schoolboys on gangs of bandits who have kidnapped other people for ransom in the northwestern Nigerian state. Then officials reversed course, tying the abductions to cattle herders at odds with farmers about how to use the land. But retired police commissioner and security analyst Lawrence Alobi disagrees with the idea that herders carried out the attack.
The herdsmen, they don't have any problem with the school authority. They don't have a problem with the students. Their problem is between farmers, where they can graze their crops and graze their cattle. So I don't know. I don't know the relationship between that adoption of those students and the farmers' clash.
Islamist militant group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the abduction of the schoolboys and released the video footage showing some of the abducted boys before their release. The claim, if verified, would mark a turning point for the group, which to date has been active almost exclusively in the northeast of the country. Security expert Kabir Adamu says he believes the abductions were carried out by bandits acting on orders from Boko Haram sect leader Abubakar Shekau.
Call may have been placed at his direct direction. What is more important is who is behind, who are the authority, who makes the calls. So if the bandit group that carried out the attack have subjected themselves to the authority of Shekau, then it means he's the one who finally make the call.
Conflicts between cattle herders and crop farmers have lingered in Nigeria for many years, and thousands have been killed during violent clashes over grazing land. The Miyeti Allah Cattle Herders Association did not speak about the accusations from police, but the group played a role in negotiating the release of the schoolboys. A lobby says blaming farmers and herders clashes for abductions may be downplaying or dismissing the possibility of expanding extremism in other regions of the country.
Government is trying to play on the psychology of the people to allay fear, but I think the government should just say to the people, so everything be based on facts.
Nigerian authorities in 2016 declared that Boko Haram was technically defeated and recently refuted the group's claims over the kidnapping, describing it as whimpers from a dying horse. But security experts will be monitoring the situation closely to see what happens next. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
The European Atlas Project studied the ecosystems of the deep Atlantic Ocean. They spanned the globe from Europe across the Mid-Atlantic Ridge to the coast of Canada and the United States. Murray Roberts is a professor of applied marine biology and ecology at the University of Edinburgh and coordinated the project. I spoke to him earlier and began our conversation by asking him why he brought together an international team.
Firstly, you have the best scientific expertise if you all work internationally, but also you can share expensive offshore equipment. You can, share the ships and share the technologies across those countries. We can't afford to do this on our own, and the ocean's a highly connected space, so it makes a lot of sense to team up internationally.
And when you talk about deep, how deep are you talking about? Because, I'm a scuba diver, and I've gone down to 100 meters, but, in terms of the ocean bottom, that's just a dip in the bucket.
It is, absolutely. So we're way beyond diver depths. Even we're way beyond deep sea industry diver depths. We're going down to hundreds to several thousands of meters water depth. Compared to the ultimate depths of the deep sea, so the so-called Hadal depths of the 11,000 meters, the greatest depths of the ocean, we're not going that deep. The Atlantic doesn't go that deep. We're not going to those trench depths. We're going typically to the offshore banks, seamounts, and the continental shelf edge and slope. So maxing out at around about 2,000 meters was where Atlas was really active, and then shallowing to around 200-300 meters depths. But at those kinds of depths, depending where you are, you get food focused to certain areas of the seabed, and in those areas you get proliferating deep sea corals and sponges. So Atlas really focused upon those special places in the Atlantic to try and understand not just how diverse they are, but how they tick. What makes them go? How do they recycle the nutrients? How do they function? We need to understand that functioning if we're going to develop long-term strategies to manage them and look after them.
Speaking of what you found in these biodiversity-rich areas, your study found 12 new species and also, over 30 species that were located in places that, mankind didn't really know was there ahead of time. So, what does, your findings and your team's findings, really tell us about the overall biodiversity at these depths?
So fundamentally, it tells us how little we know. I mean, we can go to the deep sea and map it. We'll be the first people to do so. We'll certainly be the first people to see those areas. And very often, when biologists take samples and they look at the animals that are found, we find species that have never been seen by scientists before. So in a 4.5-year project, to come up with 12 new species and get them described is fantastic, but in some ways it's not all that unexpected. We have another 30 species in new areas, as you say, which just shows how little we know about the distribution of life in the deep sea. And we have to understand that distribution because it's going to be changing. The conditions in the ocean are warming. Some areas are running out of oxygen. And across the global ocean, we're seeing an acidification signal because 30% of human CO2 emissions have dissolved in the sea. And that's making the seawater slightly more acidic, which is bad news if you're a coral built from a calcium carbonate skeleton.
Now, are these changes mainly due to climate change or a combination of climate change and human population growth on the surface?
So that's a great question. At the end of the day, the ecosystem doesn't, in a sense, care where the pressures come from. It's experiencing a whole range of pressures that are all happening at the same time and interacting with each other. But that particular stressor I mentioned, the acidification of the seas and the warming of the seas, are both directly related to carbon dioxide emissions. The more CO2 we put into the atmosphere, the warmer the planet gets, and over 90% of global heating processes have heated up the oceans, and 30% of the carbon dioxide has just dissolved in the sea, making it more acidic. So those two stressors, and in many places the lowered oxygen conditions that result from that warming of the sea, they all track back to human CO2 emissions.
Murray Roberts is a professor at the University of Edinburgh and the coordinator of the European Atlas Project. Now, there's more to our conversation, and tomorrow we'll dive into what he thought was the most interesting discovery of the study. France has lost an iconic fashion designer. Pierre Cardin has died at the age of 98, and the AP's Mike Gracia has this look at his legendary life.
Famed French designer Pierre Cardin has died, according to the French Academy of Fine Arts. He was 98. Cardin became a fashion icon beginning in the 1950s and rose to fame in the 1960s with futuristic styles that included sharp shapes and graphic patterns. In the 1970s and 80s, through aggressive licensing, the Cardin name became a world brand embossed on thousands of products from wristwatches to bedsheets. The Fine Arts Academy did not give a cause of death or say where he died. I'm Mike Gracia.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. And don't forget about our top-of-the-hour newscasts as well. Until next time. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has sanctioned two senior officials of Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security, the MOIS, for their involvement in the abduction, detention, and probable death of former FBI agent Robert Levinson, the longest-held hostage in U.S. history. Robert Levinson disappeared from Iran's Kish Island during a trip in 2007. Photographs of Mr. Levinson and a video of his pleading to be rescued from unidentified captors were sent to his family in 2011 and 2010, respectively. The Iranian government responded to requests for help in discovering what had happened to him by denying any knowledge of his whereabouts. Now the United States is holding the two MOIS officials, Mohammad Basiri and Ahmad Kazai, accountable for what the White House called their direct involvement in his abduction, detention, and probable death. It is clear that not only were senior Iranian officials responsible for Mr. Levinson's disappearance, but that they took deliberate actions to obscure their involvement through an extensive disinformation campaign, the White House noted in a written statement. With this announcement, the United States government is initiating the first public actions against the Iranian government to hold them accountable. The United States will relentlessly pursue all others involved as the investigation continues. The designation of Mohammad Basiri and Ahmad Kazai by the U.S. Department of the Treasury means that any property the men hold in the United States is blocked. No U.S. persons can do business with them, and foreign financial institutions that engage in significant transactions with him are also subject to sanctions. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo pointed out that the Iranian regime has a 41-year history of abducting and detaining foreigners and dual nationals as political leverage. We reiterate our strong warning to U.S. citizens and dual nationals that traveling to Iran may jeopardize their personal safety, he said in a statement. The abduction, detention, and probable death of Mr. Levinson is another egregious example of the regime's callous disregard toward human life, declared Secretary Pompeo. We call on the Iranian regime to provide a full accounting of Mr. Levinson's fate, and we will not rest until all Americans wrongfully detained by Iran are back home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.